Welcome to the Mothman in the Bible Belt podcast with your host, Buck Fantastic.
Girl Scout cookies.
Once upon a time, Portsmouth, Ohio was a thriving city with a ton of industry and opportunity until a 1937 flood ravaged it. In decades that followed, industry tanked and poverty and drug addiction thrived. On this episode of the Mothman in the Bible Belt podcast, I have journalist and documentarian Amanda Page. Page's work has been featured in Belt Magazine, The Daily Yonder, 100 Days in Appalachia, Literary Hub, and Yes Magazine. Paige is going to talk about her debut documentary, Peerless City, which happens to be about her hometown, Portsmouth, Ohio. We're going to discuss the dock, the so-called pill mill capital of America, Portsmouth, and poverty and drug addiction in Portsmouth and also in West Virginia. Join me, your host, Buck Fantastic, for another exciting episode of the Mothman in the Bible Belt podcast, where Southern hospitality gets served. Amanda, what inspired you to make Peerless City?
I had failed at finishing an essay that I want to say been working on, but not really, just kind of been letting cook in my head since I was about 16, when I first discovered that where Southern hospitality begins is the city slogan for my hometown. I weirdly internalized it, and like I went to graduate school in Alabama with the idea of finding out what this Southern hospitality thing is all about. I didn't have the language for it at the time, but I was definitely interested in regional culture. And I've always been interested in place. I'm a traveler. I like to see what's distinct about a place, and I like stories about places. So during the pandemic, I happened upon Moundsville on PBS. Someone mentioned it on Twitter, and I watched it and I loved it. And I started talking about it on Twitter, and I connected with the filmmakers who made it. And I said, now let's do it for Portsmouth. And we did. So it's inspired by Moundsville for sure.
This is your first doc?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What was the process like making it?
The process was a learning process. It was really, I was kind of making the path by walking, as they say. I knew that there was a planning grant with Ohio Humanities, and I went ahead and applied for that and gathered some local scholars, some local historians. And I knew that I wanted to frame it with the city slogans just because they'd always been a part of my life. Like I have that connection to where Southern hospitality begins. My brother has this connection to Peerless City, and I've been keeping an eye on the comeback city, just hearing or reading about it actually. Whenever there's a piece in the New York Times about Portsmouth, they usually interview a gentleman there who talks a lot about Portsmouth as the comeback city. So I knew I wanted to use the city slogans as a framework. And then I just gathered those scholars together, or those consultants, and we had a conversation about who we would need to talk to. And then, Ohio Humanities and Ohio Arts Council, I was applying for other grants, and the grant applications actually really helped me figure out what we would need, as well as just talking to David Bernabo, who was my co-director, and he was the co-director of Moundsville as well. And he was really the technical guy, right? Like, he knew the equipment, he knew how to do the sound, all that fun stuff. So he was the technical guy. He told me what to price out the camera equipment, et cetera, for the grant. So that was it. That was really it. By the time that we started filming, I think I wrote the first planning grant in August. We had our conversation in October. I wrote the first major grant in December. We started filming in May. And then it was May to March. We premiered it. We finished it and premiered it. So that was our timeline.
Yeah. Why did you and co-director David Bernabo choose to go at the dock as a city history piece versus taking the drug addiction slant, since Portsmouth is like, the birthplace of the pill mill?
Right. I think because I'm from Portsmouth, I'm a little bit worn out on that story. And although it's an important story for Portsmouth and it is part of our history, and I think that we couldn't tell the history of Portsmouth without at least touching on it, I knew I didn't want it to be the focus. I mean, the city slogan, Peerless City, started in the 1920s. So, you know, Portsmouth has a vast history that I just really wanted to dig into. And, you know, no city is ever one thing. So it was more interesting, I think, to ask people about the city slogans than about like, hey, what do you think of this Portsmouth drug history? I think people are just exhausted by it. So, you know, and they were a lot more charged up to talk about the slogans and something different and something positive in their lives. I mean, I've been thinking about city slogans as like aspirational prompts for the community. Like, can we aspire to be this? You know, and that's regardless if there's a pill mill there or not.
Latest figures I came across, Scioto County, where Portsmouth is located, it's the worst when it comes to unintentional drug overdose deaths in Ohio. Scioto County's unintentional drug overdose death rate is at 83.4 deaths per 100,000. That's
a lot. Yeah, and it's interesting because right now recovery is kind of big business there. Like, you know, people are coming from all over the state for rehabilitation there in Portsmouth. One thing that we talked about in the movie is, you know, is that Portsmouth was faced with the problem. So Portsmouth has innovated solutions. And that, you know, as much as people remember the story that we created the pill mill, you know, now they can look at Portsmouth and be like, they created the solution to the pill mill. The numbers are devastating, right? Like, that is a really high unintentional death rate. But also, if people come to Portsmouth for recovery services, you know, they're in a community now that really is being built around recovery. And it's kind of a circular economy. Like, I know a lot of people who have been in recovery for years who are now working in recovery. So there's a lot of layers to the knowledge that they have and the type of services that persons who suffer from addiction need. There's always pushback about whether or not people want Portsmouth to be known for the recovery. But I'm also like, well, isn't that better than just being known for the drugs? Like, it's... So
I saw that Jeanette Langford, she dismissed the notion that Portsmouth is a comeback city. At the same time, she said, for the most part, it's known as the recovery city, which is due to y'all's drug epidemic. Did the current city council and mayor want anything to do with your doc?
Yeah. So Edwin Martell, who's in it, is a former city council. He was a council member when we filmed and then became a former city council member by the time we were in post-production. So he graciously agreed to appear in the film. And then I had talked to a couple other city council members. I know Charlotte Gordon at the Southern Ohio Museum and Cultural Center has generously let me use the theater there to do screenings of the film. And then the current mayor, I did have coffee with him at one point, and it was our conversation that prompted me to have a couple experts in the film that were not from Portsmouth, but talking about the importance of, or just the uses of a city slogan. Because I don't think it's obvious to everybody. I mean, I interviewed people who were like, I didn't even know that was our city slogan. And getting some context around what city slogans are was important.
Before the interview, I glanced over some census data for Portsmouth, Ohio. The population as of July 2021 last year is 18,014 people. Poverty rate, 35.2%. Per capita income is like 22,000. How can anyone survive there? And that's enough to turn anyone to drugs, you know?
Yeah, it has. Portsmouth has been hit with hard times. No doubt. I mean, I can remember when I first left and I kept coming home for holidays, and it was like someone else had died. Another building had been torn down. I mean, it was getting real bleak there for a while. I have seen the city turn a corner in terms of like downtown revitalization. There seems to be kind of some new energy there. And of course, the rise of the recovery centers as, you know, major employment in the area. But yeah, I mean, it's been a pretty poor county for as long as I can remember. As Appalachian as it gets in some ways, I just wrote a piece about this magazine article from 1989 that always stuck with me. It was in Life magazine and it was called Children of Poverty. And I can remember some of the frustration people had with it. But, you know, the editor of Life magazine had put out a call trying to find a family that fit, like, you know, that lived in poverty, and they found one in Portsmouth. And it is like a real snapshot of generational poverty. I don't want to say it's bleak though, because there's so much happening there. And also I think too, like, although those numbers are probably from the city proper, I mean, I know we just talked about Scioto County, Portsmouth kind of works in the tri-state area. Like, you've got people in South Shore all the way to Huntington to, you know, so there's a corner there in that we call the tri-state, that that's West Virginia, Kentucky, and Ohio. And, you know, those numbers aren't quite as bleak.
Did you and your family deal with a ton of poverty growing up in Portsmouth yourself, and drug addiction, or?
I'm very, very fortunate. My mother was an elementary school teacher. She's a first generation college student. And my father is, he was a city firefighter. So no, my family in particular, I mean, very working class, you know, my grandfather was able to raise his family as a school janitor, very working class. And, you know, we lived in an area that had the highest number of low income housing units in the county. But it never, it was just part of, you know, my friends lived in the Kiwanis apartments, and I was in and out of there all the time. It was very, I don't want to say I dealt with it. But I think it was definitely present. But I don't know how much of my awareness at the time, too, of being, you know, as a young child, I really, what I took to heart.
A 1937 flood wreaked havoc on Portsmouth. It did a lot of industries and that operated in the city. Did outsourcing make it worse?
The counseling center is moving into what was once the Mitchell Lace building. And I can remember once, it was just me and my dad. We went to dinner at Captain D's, and we ran into some, like, old high school friends of his. And the wife of the couple said, yeah, Guatemala made a mistake, so I've got a job again for 2 weeks. And I was like, I didn't know what was happening at Mitchell Lace, but I that stuck with me, and I didn't even really investigate it, and I still don't. But I remember just hearing that and thinking, oh, well, I didn't realize the whole operation had moved so far. But there was still enough equipment in Mitchell Lace for people to come back for 2 weeks to get a job done.
When things were booming in Portsmouth before the flood, were things as remotely dire as they currently are?
I know that after the flood, there were people who stayed, right? And, like, really cleaned up their homes and put immense effort into making Portsmouth their first comeback. I don't know exactly how many cycles we've had, because, you know, there's a moment in the film where Frank Gerlach, the former mayor, is talking about one of the slogans and how it was meant to inspire hope and be a positive thing at a time when Portsmouth was sort of depressed, I think were his exact words. And that was in the 60s. So I wonder how many times there's this, you know, Portsmouth was sort of depressed versus, you know, Portsmouth is very depressed. Because I can tell you that year, 1989, like, I remember Portsmouth is booming. There was a giant department store downtown. There was an escalator. There was a bookstore. There were several bookstores in town. Like, it was booming. There was a business in every building downtown. So, you know, and here we are, the children of poverty. So it's really interesting. Like, there was always wild income juxtaposition, right? Like, high income, low income, or middle income, low income juxtaposition there, always.
Do you think cities rebranding themselves actually help make them more commercially marketable to the right kinds of businesses that pay living wages and offer employees good benefits?
God, that's a great question. I don't know the answer. I don't know that a listicle has ever made me want to go to a place. And I don't know, I mean, my interest in city slogans, you know, because of where I'm from, I've looked at city slogans across the nation and even like state slogans and, you know, just place slogans essentially. And I don't know that it really attracts business, you know, and sometimes it's supposed to attract tourists. And I can't really tell you, the one that stands out to me because it's funny is Colorado. And that's the state of Colorado. Their slogan is everybody's high. And I'm just like, haha, that's clever. But I don't know. I don't know how much, you know, business relocates there for that. But I bet they get tourists.
Oh, yeah.
No, I saw like only 14.7% of Portsmouth has a bachelor's degree. And tuition and fees at Shawnee State, which is located in Portsmouth, it's like $4,670 per semester. And my alma mater at West Virginia State University, it's $4,416 with tuition and fees. That's kind of unaffordable for many. My state will pay for an associate's degree. Does Ohio subsidize education like that? Or
So Shawnee State actually just announced an initiative to pay tuition and fees. I don't know all the details about it, but they did just announce something. It's traditionally been a university that serves first generation college students. So, you know, that population is still pretty high in the region. No, in comparison, it's incredibly affordable. And in some universities, some of the state universities, that number has, I know, has stopped many a person. Just it seems impossible in their minds.
A huge problem that we as West Virginians face in terms of self-induced poverty is that we don't have enough of the population with bachelor's, associates, and technical degrees and certifications to help make the state more commercially marketable. According to the U.S. Census, 21.3% of West Virginia's population has a bachelor's or higher. In Ohio, that rate is 28.9%. Our poverty rate is about 3% higher than Ohio's. On top of that, the wills on economic diversification efforts in West Virginia have only started rolling the past few years. Many tout having a college degree will result in higher wages, yet many positions that require those degrees in state, county, and city government in West Virginia pay less than 30 grand. Many private businesses and nonprofits pay similarly. If you want to live comfortably and you're single, you need to make $15, $16 an hour in Charleston to afford rent, mortgage, food, utilities, and insurance at $3 or $4 per hour per child. One thing that I've noticed that's missing from a lot of discussions and a lot of documentaries on poverty is people talking about living wages, talking about paid leave. I mean, poverty is fueling the drug epidemic here locally. I was in AmeriCorps Vista a few years back at this homeless continuum of care provider in Charleston, and I spoke to this woman at Prestera. She deals with people who have mental health problems who are homeless. And she said some of the people that she spoke to who developed drug addiction problems who were homeless, they developed their problems as soon as they wound up homeless. They didn't like all of a sudden, you know, I mean, it's different for everybody. But I think people, whether it's in West Virginia or Ohio, a lot of people are turning to drugs to numb it. And even then, to numb the pain of being poor, to numb the pain of being homeless. But I don't know, did any of the policymakers on the city level that you spoke to in Portsmouth, were they talking about living wages or anything like that?
I haven't had many of those conversations, although I was just having a conversation, not in any kind of official capacity, but with one of the council members about workforce development, because that's part of what my nonprofit is doing there. I mean, I have the nonprofit, we have this documentary filmmaking arm, but also I've got an internship program. Those are paid positions. And the idea is that people will learn social media management, documentary filmmaking, and arts administration. And that's, you know, those are jobs that, you know, depending on a number of factors, you know, they don't have to be poverty level wage. And they're in the arts, and that's not something I think in workforce development conversations or economic development conversations, the arts will be talked about as like something to draw tourists in, but it's not really like homegrown, like let's pay our artists.
Something you make a lot of money off of.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there are conversations starting to begin around that. I know that in Portsmouth, even before the no one wants to work narrative kind of leaked into the pipeline, into the stream, it was really hard. Like there were a lot of fast food jobs, but especially like coming out of recovery, like that's still not necessarily a living wage. And even if you're not coming out of recovery, I mean, it's still just not a living wage. And I don't know that there were really enough teenagers to fill those positions. So what I'm trying to make the leap to is talking about, you know, a lot of the recovery centers are hiring persons who have graduated from their programs, and those jobs are typically much better paying. You know, we just haven't seen the big factory come in. That I don't know if people are still hoping for that or not. You know, there's a lot of talk about entrepreneurship. I know Shawnee State has the Cricker Innovation Hub, and they run a free summer training called Ignite Portsmouth, and that's to train burgeoning entrepreneurs. You know, I think that's really the hope. I know that esports is popular, and I know that's definitely a big hope for a lot of places in terms of economic development. So esports is popular in Portsmouth as well. But to answer your question, living wage is not top of the conversations I'm having, but that's strictly the conversations I'm having. So I don't know if they're being had in different rooms or at different tables.
I know in West Virginia, 2019, I was at a Charleston Homeless Task Force meeting, and the head of the United Way of Central West Virginia told the entire room that, according to her research, people of Charleston could live on $11 an hour. And the following year, an organization that's funded by the United Way, Covenant House, then executive director Ellen Allen, she wrote an op-ed stating, "You need $15 to afford a 2-bedroom unit." She wrote that 6 months after Margaret O'Neill said that. And I'm like, there's a huge disconnect here. And
huge.
People are not in the nonprofit world. They don't want to talk about it. Many of these people are making huge salaries. Salaries of many of these charities' heads is ridiculously high. The United Way of Central West Virginia executive director Margaret O'Neill brought in $94,000 last year. In 2020, Mountaineer Food Bank CEO Justin Morrison earned $120,000. YWCA Charleston CEO Debbie Weinstein brought in $130,000 in 2020. And this is the worst. In 2020, Goodwill Industries of Kanab Valley CEO Daniel Owen raked in $208,000. That's the highest that I've seen in West Virginia. You can find these salaries on ProPublica's Nonprofit Explorer website. And many of these nonprofits, they're milking poverty, and they're paying many of their employees wages which they can't even get by on. I was at Sojourner's homeless shelter as a Vista a few years back, and many of those employees were working two jobs to get by. And Sojourners is a part of the YWCA Charleston, and that many of those people saw their pays froze for years. And when they did get a pay raise, they were getting 10-cent raises. And I saw on ProPublica's website, Debbie Weinstein was constantly getting a raise.
Yeah. I mean, that's been the CEO, it's like a bubble, right? Or I've heard for decades now that that's a bubble, that, you know, their pay is increased. I don't know what the actual number is, but I mean, it's outside of reality with what, you know, wages of their, even corporate, and I'm thinking in corporate circles, really.
This is like nonprofit.
Yeah, yeah.
That's horrible.
I wonder how much that has to do with the old, like, well, I don't know if it's old thinking, because I think a lot of it still goes on, but the charity, like we're granting charity. Do you know what I mean? So there's like a person of means who has to run it because they are granting charity to the poor. Does that make sense? That's an actual type of thinking. Yeah. That it's terrible. I mean, what I'm saying is terrible.
And many of these nonprofits are taking money from people who are poisoning and impoverishing their communities.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's really horrible. Do you all have a problem with charities, I guess, just milking poverty in Ohio, like not actually talking about solutions, or people actually trying to at least engage the public on like conversations that actually results in people getting out of the poorhouse, getting sustainably housed, and, you know, cleaning themselves up.
It's so interesting because I can't name one in Ohio, like off the top of my head, but yes, absolutely. I'm going to say that we have that problem in Ohio. And I'll tell you, out of touch has been the word for, you know, leadership and, you know, the disconnect between leadership and the, you know, public they're supposed to serve. And one thing that I keep seeing is the layers, you know, people want to be data driven. They want to be evidence-based and they'll gather all this data, but it's numbers on a piece of paper. And I just last week came across a company that's here in Cincinnati that they refer to themselves as an community engagement and strategy organization. And the whole idea is to get everyday experts, which are like the people in the neighborhoods who are doing the work, at the table with the decision makers and the policy makers. And then they're supposed to listen to one another. And I'm like, you need a whole company to facilitate that? Like, this isn't like, this isn't what policymakers and decision makers should be doing. That's their job, right? Like, shouldn't they be talking to their constituents? Like, but I mean, now there's a company that facilitates that. And, you know, otherwise I think that it's easier for people to extract resources or milk, like you're saying, if people aren't people, they're numbers on a report that they can spend money to have someone else go gather the information. Do you know what I mean?
In West Virginia, most of the drug addiction advocates are pushing medication-assisted treatment, MAT, like naloxone, to curb the overdose rate. It's great as a short-term fix, but it doesn't address the underlying causes as to how people got hooked on opioids to begin with, like workplace or home injuries, generational drug use, and poverty. How do you think Ohio and West Virginia can fix our opioid problems? I mean, they're different, but they're alike in that many of them are being fueled by poverty.
I don't have an answer beyond we need to listen to the people who suffer from addiction, you know, and what led you here? What would have helped? They have the answers, right? I just think we need to start there.
In my city, it's like they just want a drug. They want to take people off of one drug and they want to put them on another. And it's not that it's a bad thing, but it's just keeping this mentality that if we want to fix any problem, whether it's a drug problem, a depression problem, a high blood pressure problem, a cholesterol problem, mm-hmm. a weight problem, you take a pill for it.
Yeah.
It conditions people to be drug addicts, in my opinion, with all these ads on television. You know, it's like, do drugs, do drugs, do drugs. And yet no one wants to talk about that. So.
No, I know the number of pill cases that you see, like the fancy pill cases that like they're, it's, you know, so people can organize their 15 or 16. It's, yeah, it's incredible. But yeah, I mean, you know, the reality of that is that big pharma is big business and has deep, deep pockets. So I, you know, trying to come at it from a very grassroots level is a little intimidating.
It is. Do you think putting more money into depressed, anxious people's hands who are grappling with drug addiction will help turn the tide in the U.S. when it comes to the opioid epidemic?
I mean, in the form of something like a guaranteed basic income. Yeah. Yeah, I think that would make a huge difference.
I know several cities used the CARES Act money and the ARPA money to partially finance universal basic income programs, but it's not being discussed in West Virginia.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatsoever.
It's so, I mean, I think especially in places where the narrative of welfare fraud and like mm-hmm. people getting something for nothing, I think it's a much harder conversation to explain universal basic income because of, I mean, that's a narrative that we've got to work hard to change, for sure.
As far as I'm concerned, If you live in a state where policymakers aren't focusing on economic diversification, attracting good paying jobs to your state, you should go after every damn dime you get. I mean, that's because they're doing it to you. The policymakers are responsible for that. They're responsible for the poverty that you're experiencing, so they should realistically take care of you until you're able to fully stand on your own 2 feet without any assistance. Do you think Portsmouth is going to have a happy ending or wind up a ghost town?
Maybe both. Maybe its happy ending is that it's, I mean, I used to say I grew up in a ghost because you could kind of see its former glory. And I think you still can, but it's also like there's a glory in it still. And I think part of the comeback city, I'm going to call it an initiative, although it's not that formal, is, you know, they want to see it vibrant again, maybe not in exactly the same way. I think there's hope for it. I think there's hope for it. I have some hope for it, for sure.
When will PBS be airing their cut of Your Doc?
Great question. We just premiered it March 26, 2022. And I have been arranging viewings of it across the state of Ohio and West Virginia. And what I really want to do is exhaust that for at least a year. Mm-hmm. And then the shorter version will be on PBS.
Do you have any upcoming screenings in West Virginia you want to?
I do not, although I will say I've reached out to a couple places in Huntington. And I am extending the invitation. If there are places in West Virginia that would be interested in screening the film, please get in touch with me.
Culture Center in Charleston would be a great place. It's like 500 some seat. That's where a great deal of the documentaries around here are shown.
Let's do it.
I think it's affordable too.
Fantastic. And because I'm not charging a screening fee, like a lot of times it's like, if they need to charge tickets for their entry, you know, that's fine. But tomorrow it's showing at the Bony Fiddle Fringe Festival in Portsmouth. And that's a ticketed event, but those tickets really, the money goes to the festival. So if places are gracious enough to waive their fee and just show the film, that's always a great model too.
What do you hope people that view Peerless City take away from Your Doc?
A few things. One, just the intense, incredible natural beauty of Portsmouth, as well as the small city charm of it. When I'm there, I barely drive. I walk everywhere. I don't have a ton of coffee shops to choose from, but the two that I do, I think is the best damn coffee in the state. Like, but also I think just the resilience of a community. And I want to say something too about the diversity in Appalachia that we don't get to, you know, people still, I was just working with a team that came to do a story on Portsmouth. They were from New York and it was very much like, why do these people, and it's just it's you know, another Trump country thing, I think. And I really just want people to see that there's more to us.
For more information on Peerless City and to find out where the doc is being screened, check out www.peerlesscity.com. I want to thank my special guest, Amanda Page. Her doc gives viewers a glimpse into Portsmouth, Ohio's past and present. Only through examining our troubled past can we paint a more vibrant future. For Mothman and the Bible Belt podcast outlet updates, guest bios, and links to social media, please visit www.mothmanandthebiblebelt.com. Thanks for listening!